Yeah. Yeah, sure.
Thank you.
There's a few more here. Who else needs one?
There are extras.
There are extras there? Fine.
He's a running, yeah?
Chazal make two parallel statements. I've never heard them brought together, but it occurred to me that they very much parallel each other. One says, Kol dor she'eino nivna bet hamikdash biyamav ma'alin alav ke'ilu hu hechrivo, which is any generation in which the Beit HaMikdash is not rebuilt in its day, they should consider themselves ke'ilu they are the ones that are responsible for bringing about the destruction. That's fairly well known. Equally well known, but I think sometimes not associated, is another ke'ilu. B'chol dor v'dor chayev adam lirot et atzmo ke'ilu hu yatza mimitzrayim. And I think, which is of course translated as, in every generation, each person should regard themselves as if they came out of Mitzrayim. And these two ke'ilus, I think, parallel each other very strongly. And of course, this is a parallel which Chazal point out in many different ways, which is the parallel between Pesach, which is the Chag HaGeula, and Tisha B'Av, which is the day that we focus on Galut. And Chazal were very conscious of this link. And they point out that the night on which Pesach happens, the Seder night, which happened on Monday night, is the same night as Tisha B'Av happened, which was on Monday night. And even the egg that we eat on Seder night is connected with the egg that we eat as Tisha B'Av come in. And therefore Chazal, I think, wanted us very much to connect these two days, the day of Geula and the day of Galut, and both of them are ke'ilus, meaning we don't really feel on a day-to-day basis like we came out of Mitzrayim, but somehow or other on Seder night we have to ke'ilu, we have to get ourselves out of our daily lives into a mindset that we feel like we ourselves are going through a sense of Geula. And similarly, on Tisha B'Av, even though we don't really feel like Tisha B'Av, we somehow have to get ourselves out of our daily routines and feel like we are understanding and part of the whole period of Galut. And that's why I think that both Pesach is hard, Seder night is hard, to get into that mindset. And in my experience, sometimes it works better than other times. But Tisha B'Av is equally hard. And whatever year it seems to be, as far as I can see, it's hard to get into the mood of Tisha B'Av. Sometimes a person feels too happy to get into the mood of Tisha B'Av. I remember Rav Emanuel Jacobovitz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was the chief rabbi before, the last chief rabbi in England, telling me that he came to Yerushalayim in 1967, after the Six-Day War, and they sat at the Kotel on Tisha B'Av, 1967, which was just a month and a half after the Six-Day War, and he says they didn't know what to do. They didn't know whether to sit and cry, to dance and sing. He says they just were so conflicted they didn't know what to do. I saw also one of my friends in America, who is now a senior Jewish leader, says he remembers Tisha B'Av in the year 2000, when Senator Joseph Lieberman had just been nominated for the vice president of the American election in 2000, and the Jews felt all over America that Judaism was central to the American dream. Everybody was lauding Senator Lieberman, everybody loved Judaism, everybody saw Judaism as central to their lives.
Jewish or not Jewish. And he said they also didn't know whether to laugh and dance because this didn't feel like galut, or to somehow get in the mood of Tisha B'Av. So this year I think it's equally difficult. Not because we're dancing and singing, but because we're enmeshed in our own immediate matzav. And on a certain level, I think that's also difficult to connect with Tisha B'Av. Come, find a seat, please.
Okay.
So take a sheet.
They have sheets.
And for reasons that I hope to explain, the fact that we are currently living through a time of pain and stress, I don't think that makes it actually any easier to get into the mood of Tisha B'Av. Because Tisha B'Av, as I will hopefully show you over the next few minutes, is not really about the here and now. It still requires us to get into a ke'ilu, to get out of the matzav that we're in, whether that's a matzav of joy or whether that's a matzav of tzar. It requires us to get out of that matzav and think in a much bigger picture and think about galut in a much more klali, much more gadol way. And therefore, I think that this is a very difficult thing this year as in other years. And hopefully I will show you what the seeds of Geula are building through Galut, but Galut have to be understood. And Tisha B'Av is a festival, and it is a festival, it's a Moed, we'll see soon how that works, on which we have to really get to grips with what is Galut. So let's first of all get ourselves into the mood of the day and understand what we're meant to be doing. I brought you a source sheet here, which first I try to understand what is Tisha B'Av all about. So these sources at the beginning are fairly well known. So you see, I'm a Rabbi Yehuda, I'm a Rav. Kach haya minhago shel Rabbi Yehuda b'Rabbi Eloi. So Rav brings down the minhagim of the Tanaim. This is what they would do. Erev Tisha B'Av, mevi'in lo pat, they would bring him bread, chareva, which is dry, b'melach, in salt. V'yoshev ben tanu l'kiraim, and he would sit in an uncomfortable, hot place. V'ochel, and he would eat, v'shote alea kiton shel maim, and he would drink water. V'dome kemi shemeto mutar lefanav. And he would try to get into the mindset of someone who is meisoi mutar lefanav, that the dead lies right before them. And Chazal are telling us, this is the way we're meant to feel, right now. Especially on Tisha B'Av morning, in the AM, before the mood lifts a little bit of chatzot, and we get up off the floor, and we sit on chairs, and then we can start thinking forward to Nachumu, Nachumu, Ami. We start to think more in Nechama in the afternoon, but in the morning we don't feel that way. We're not meant to feel that way. We're meant to feel like Meso Mutl Lefanov. And you see this reflected as well in number 2, which is a source from the Sechet Sofrim. This is not our minag, but the person who is called up to read on Tisha B'Av should start Omer Baruch Dayan Ha'emes. Should start by saying Baruch Dayan Ha'emes. V'yesh menichim es ha-Torah ala karka, those who put the Torah itself on the floor, ba'afchi lo tshoyre, in a black frame, so it's not lying on the floor, but it's resting on the floor. V'oimrim, and they say a posik, which we'll come back to, nafla ateres roshenu, a posik from Eicha, that the crown of our heads has fallen. V'koirim, and they rip their clothes. U'maspidim, they give hespedim, ke'adam shemesu mutl lefanav. Just like we do when we're standing at a levaya before the kvura, before the burial, and the mace is in front of us, then we engage in an activity of hesped, kriya, baruch dain emes. These are the things that we do, and therefore this is what Chazal is telling us that we have to somehow feel today. So, what is the purpose of speaking on Tisha B'Av morning? Clearly the purpose is to give some kind of a hesped. That's what we're meant to be doing. We're meant to be maspidin al hames. So what is a hesped? So I'm sure everybody in this room has been to hespedim. A hesped carries with it a number of different implications. One of them, of course, is to make people cry. Have a look in number 3. Amar Rav Sheshes. Igra
the hespeter. The reward, the purpose, the function, the goal of a hesped is deluye. Rashi says deluye means laharim kol, to lift our voices balosh and nay in moaning, bagmas nefesh and distress. Sheiv ku hashemim, that the people should cry. And indeed, one of the things that people do at a hesped, of course, is to make the people who are standing by the mace feel the sense of loss, feel the sense of mourning, feel the crying because of the dead person. But there's another purpose of a hesped, which is not that at all. If you look in number 4, the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, Hespeda, what is a hesped? Yakra de chaye hava, is it meant to be honor for the living? Or yakra de shrivi hava, or is it meant to be a sense of honor for the dead? And after a long discussion in the Gemara back and forth between the two tzadim, between the two sides, it concludes shmamina. The conclusion is yakra de shrivi hu, it is meant to be kavod hamet, shmamina, and that's how we rule. And therefore the hesped itself, we're standing here meant to be doing some kind of a hesped for a mace, we'll see who that mace is in a minute. The hesped could either be to arouse us in crying and tears, or it could also be kavod hamet. And some kvurot, some burials, are not people crying and tearing their clothes, but they're gathering around a mace, appreciating the met, understanding the life of the person, and they don't have that same raw emotional component. And the same is true of shivas as well. I'm sure people have been at shivas where there's a sense of tragedy, there's a sense of raw emotion and distress, and there are other shivas where there's a sense of appreciation of the person who lived, a sense of wanting to talk about their lives. There's not that same sense of distress depending on the nature of the person, and therefore Chazal recognized there are different kind of hespedim. I think on Tisha B'Av, the hesped that we're trying to get to is the hesped of Kavod Hamet, which I'll show you in a minute. Because there's one very big difference between Tisha B'Av, the Avelut of Tisha B'Av, and the Avelut of a normal situation of loss. And that is as follows. I brought you a pasuk from Eicha. This pasuk that they brought in Masechet Sofrim in source 2, Nafla Ateret Roshenu, look at the last line of the pasuk. What are we doing on Tisha B'Av? Are we crying, Nafla Ateret Roshenu, the crown of our heads has fallen, Oina Lanu Ki Chatanu, which is not what we say at a Levaya. We don't go round at a Shiva or a Levaya saying, Oina Lanu Ki Chatanu. That's not the time. It's not the time to start pointing the finger. Why did this happen? It must be because of this. Maybe it's because of that. Yet on Tisha B'Av, that does seem to be what's going on. Ayya lanu ki chatanu. And therefore, I think that the nature of Tisha B'Av is quite different in many ways than the nature of a normal levaya. If you look for a second at source 8, we'll come back to 6 and 7. Source 8 points this out. Chazal say, Amar Rav Ashi, Sha'ani Avelus Chadasha Me'Avelus Hashana. A new, recent Avelus Lo Yaleinu for a lost loved one is quite different. An Avelut Chadasha is different from an Avelut Yashana. The Avelut that we have on Tisha B'Av is not the sense of recent, raw, emotional loss. It's an old loss. It's something that happened many, many years ago. Veshani Avelut derabim me Avelut deyachid. And the difference, there's also a difference, say Chazal, between the Avelut derabim, when we're all together trying to get in a mindset of Avelut, and an Avelut deyachid. And I want to suggest to you that an Avelut deyachid, a person standing in a levaya lo yaleinu, is emotional, is distressed, and is not focused on tshuva. Tshuva is not the mitzvah tayom. Whereas an avilut derabim, an avilut yeshana, the focus is very strongly on tshuva. Why is the focus on tshuva? All the time through Eicha we see a concept of chet, again, which is not mentioned at a normal avilut. Look at number 7. Chet chata Yerushalayim. Al kei lenida haita.
all the way through Eicha that we read last night, and some people read again this morning, we're mentioning constantly Chatanu, Chatanu, the chetz of our fathers, the chetz of ourselves, etc. That seems to be much more the focus, and we'll see that leads to a process of tshuva in a minute, and therefore the dead, the mesa mutl lefanav, the dead that lies in front of us today, is actually the death of our own past. It's the death of our own lost opportunities. We are ourselves the mate on a certain level. Look at number 6. Rishaim shebechayehem krui meitim. Say Chazal, those people who are Rishaim, and we bang our chests and we say Chatanu, we are those people, we are the meitim. They're krui meitim, Shneemar. It brings a pasuk. Apishnaim edim o shloisha edim yumut hameit. It says that when you have to execute a criminal through two or three witnesses, the dead will die. Some of Gemara says, the dead? He's not dead yet. He's only dead when you kill him. Chayu, he's alive. No, he's not. Ela hameitz, heimitz meikara. He's dead already from the beginning. And therefore, the hesped that we're giving today is a hesped on ourselves. Not on ourselves in a sense of avelut chadasha. Nobody's died, God forbid. But we're giving a hesped on the loss of the past, the loss of our community, the missed opportunities, the galut as a whole. And that is the mate hamutal lefanav. That is the death in front of us. It is the galut that we have to give a hesped for. And that hesped, as I said, is a hesped not only of crying, and sometimes thinking about our galut leads us to tears, but sometimes it leads us to a sense of kavod hamates, of trying to work out what is the, how do we understand that mate, how do we talk about that mate, how do we think about that mate. And as I said to you before, Tisha B'Av is a day of tshuva as well. It's not just a day of mourning. Masha'en kein avelut. Look at number 9. The Rambam says, Yesham yamim, there are certain days, shekol Yisrael mitanim bahem, that all the Jews must fast, mitnei hatzaras she'iru bahem, because of the terrible disasters that happened, kedei lo erer halavavos, so that we can raise our hearts, our minds, liftoyach darchei tshuva. He brings this in the end of Hilchos Tanis, to renew our sense of tshuva. The year says zikaron lemaaseinu, we can remember what happened. It's a zikaron. There's a mitzvah of zikaron. Haraim, our bad actions, our negative actions, umaaseh avoseinu, and those of our fathers, shehayakem maaseinu, because they are like our actions. Ata now, ad shegorim lahem v'lanu oisem atzar, because they led to all of this. Shebezikaron dvarim elu nashuv lehetev. Because through remembering those things, we will gain a sense of perspective which will help us to do tshuva. Shneemar v'hizvadu es avoinam ve'es avon avosam. This, I think, is very important. The finale of Eicha is not just chatanu, but hashiveinu Hashem alecha. V'nashuva. There is a positive focus. And even in the morning of Tisha B'Av, even on the night of Tisha B'Av, there is a focus on tshuva, which at the end of the day, as I said before, is quite different to the feeling that we get at a funeral, where there is no focus on tshuva because the emotions are too raw, it's too fresh, it's too much of an avelut chadasha. My rav in England, Rabbi Kimchi, would always say on Tisha B'Av, the mitzvah's hayoim is to learn Jewish history. The mitzvah of the day is to read through the pages of Jewish history from not just the destruction of the Churban, but through the development of the Jewish people, through the Middle Ages, through the modern times, through the Holocaust. Not just to make us sit and cry, oi, look at the tragedies, look at the atrocities that were done to our people. That's part of it. And that's not wrong to do that. But it's also to get a sense of perspective, to get around the enormity of the Galut, something that we can't do on a daily basis. Just like on Pesach, our requirement is to get our heads into the enormity of Geula, something which again we can't do on a daily basis. So too Tisha B'Av, we have to start thinking of it as a Moed. What is a Moed? The Eicha calls Tisha B'Av Moed. There are halachic implications. We don't say Tachanun. We don't. There are certain mitzvahs that apply almost like a chag on a certain level. A moed literally means a meeting. It's where certain strands come together. Certain themes seem to mesh together through history that meet in a certain way that spark a certain realization that something big is going on. That's why Pesach is a moed. Rav Soloveitchik, in his book, The Emergence of Ethical Man, which came out posthumously, describes what is a nes. A nes is where the Jewish historical destiny somehow connects just for a second with the physical created world around us. And something happens that makes us realize that nature is in consonance with our Jewish destiny. When the sea splits just when we need it, at that moment when we need to cross, that is like a moed. We see things coming together. It doesn't even need to be supernatural. It could be that the wind blows this way, the wind blows that way, and the sea splits. That's fine. But the fact that it happens there and then, that's what makes it a moed. That's what gives us a chag. And in a certain sense, Tisha B'Av is also a moed because we need to be able to see these strands coming together. And that's why I'd like to look with you at a few sources that deal with the nature of Galut. And what Galut is really meant to be about. And how we're meant to see within Galut the seeds of Geula. And again, I'm not doing this to make us to feel better. I don't think that's the purpose now. The purpose is not to make us feel a nechama. The purpose is to be maspid. The purpose is to give a hesped on the mate. And the mate is the galut in front of us that we need to understand. Therefore, I want to show you two main pieces. If we have time, we'll have time for more. Which are a very beautiful piece from Rav Hirsch. And a very beautiful piece from Rav Kook, who both give complementary understandings of what Galut is, which will help us, I think, see within Galut the seeds of Geula in a way which perhaps we hadn't thought about it before. Okay. If you look at the two sources I brought you in number 11 and 12, you'll see Chazal give us two different focuses on Galut. Why is there Galut in its klali sense? We say every Musaf on Yom Tov in number 11, "Nipnei chataynu galinu me'atzenu v'nisrachaknu mi'alad maseinu." Why are we in Galut? Why does Galut happen? This whole process of exile? It's our fault. Chatanu. By the way, Rav Lef often points out that nowhere does it say chatatem. Nowhere do you point the finger. Ashamtem, bagadtem, gazaltem. That's not what we say. It's ashamnu, bagadnu, gazalnu. And therefore pointing the finger at other groups within Klal Yisrael as to you're the problem, you're the reason why this happened, is actually adding insult to the injury, is causing more of the problem. The issue is chatanu. Therefore that is definitely one of the focuses of Galut. We have to make good the chet that we did. And Rav Hirsch will focus us on what that chet is. But number 12 is a source from Gemara in Pesachim that talks, gives a different focus. Lo higla kodesh baruch es Yisrael lebein ha'umos. Why did God send us to the nations in exile? Ela kedei she'itoisfu aleihem geirim. So that we could attract geirim. We could shine the light of Judaism out to the non-Jewish world and attract people to Judaism. Shene'emar, and he brings a very interesting pasuk which we'll dwell on later. Uzratiha li ba'aretz. Hashem has sown us into the land. And this mashal of zriya, of sowing, we will get again and again and again in our understanding of exile. Which we'll see as we go through the next few minutes. God has sown us into the landscape of the non-Jewish world as a means to be makarev on a certain level the non-Jewish world. So these are two different themes within Galut. Chatanu and also Or Legoyim in that sense. Let's have a look now at this short passage from Rav Hirsch. Rav Shem Shrofal Hirsch lived in the mid-19th century. He wrote a very important early book called Chorev. Chorev was his philosophy of the mitzvot, the ta'amei ha-mitzvot, the reasons why the mitzvot apply in the way that they do. And it was a very big and very revolutionary book. And when he took it to the author, to the publishers, they said to him, "We ain't going to publish this until we know anyone's going to buy it. This is a very dangerous and risky venture because no one has ever written like this before." Rav Hirsch, don't forget, was living in a new age. He was living in an age of reform, Judaism, and no one had ever written a book out, reaching out to the people who were now enmeshed in the reform world. So they said to him, "Can you write something else which is like shorter as a kind of market tester?" So he wrote another book at their request, which he called The 19 Letters of Ben Uziel, which he published anonymously, and he synopsized, if that's a word, the basic themes of Chorev, and he said to the publishers, "Look, if people like this, and this sells well, then that's a siman that people will like the big book, and that'll also sell well." So they said, "Good, we'll do that." So that's why he wrote The 19 Letters, and of course The 19 Letters, in its own right, became a classic of Rav Hirsch, and of course sold brilliantly, and was a revolution in German thinking in the Jewish world, and therefore Chorev came out shortly afterwards, which deals with that in more depth and detail. But Chorev was the one that was written first. So if we're going to look together at the ninth of the 19 letters, or at least a part of the ninth of the 19 letters, which deals with Galut, and we'll see what he says. We're not going to focus on all the issues here, but look here at number 13. I'm sorry it's a little bit small, but I'll read it out with you. "Only for a short time was Israel able to attain its ideal, the fulfillment of its mission amidst prosperity. Even Moses, the first leader of the nation, foretold that once upon God's soil, the children of Israel would forget God." That's the Kriya of the Torah we just read this morning. Kitzolidvan. Okay? So our moments, our heyday, the golden age that we look back to is actually very short and not as golden as we sometimes think. Each person living in prosperity and peace is a few years during the reign of Shlomo HaMelech. If you open the rest of Tanakh, if you look at the rest of the Bayit Rishon, it looks very much like the life that we have today. Peace, and then we have to fight the Plishtim, and they won't go away, and David fights them, and they won't go away, and Shlomo fights them, and they won't go away, and it looks a bit more like that. "Led astray by the example of the other nations, they would esteem only wealth and pleasures as desirable." In other words, the Jewish people became focused on money and would become oblivious to their mission. "There came the time when even in Israel the prophet could lament, as the number of their cities were thy gods, O Judah." And Rav Hirsch is playing with this posik. It doesn't just mean that we had as many pagan gods as there are cities, but it means we made our cities into our pagan gods. That we invested in the land and felt that the land was the goal. "Look what we've built, look what we've made, look what we've created." So that becomes an avodah zarah. "It became necessary to take away the abundance of earthly goods, the wealth, the land which had led Israel to stray from its mission. Israel was forced to leave the happy soil which has seduced it from its allegiance to the Most High. Nothing was to be saved except the soul of its existence, the Torah. No other bond of unity was henceforth to exist except God and its mission, which are indestructible because they are spiritual concepts." What we were left with, that's why Chazal say once we destroyed, once the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, all we had was the Dalet Amos of Halacha, meaning we had to focus inwards. We didn't have the cities, the highways, the infrastructure, the buildings. We didn't have any of that anymore. All we had was our inner spiritual mission. So for 2,000 years we've had to focus on that in the hope that what? That once we get back to our buildings, our infrastructure, our cities, then we will know again how to relate to them in the right way, and we will no longer see them as the goal. "But Israel's mission did not cease with the end of its statehood, for that had been intended only as a means to an end." Very important. Rav Hirsch wants to say that the concept of a Jewish Medina, which he was not opposed to in any sense, although he was not so in favor of the early Zionist, the seeds of the Zionist movement, he didn't see that as being necessarily a move in the right direction. In 1860s, 70s, it was not clear how it would work out. But he said it's very important to understand that what we have here in Eretz Israel is a means to an end. On the contrary, this destruction itself was part of Israel's lot, another aspect of Israel's fulfillment of its calling. And then he makes an interesting point. Israel had been guilty of sins no different from those that had prevailed in the other nations. We didn't act any worse than anybody else. We didn't do anything any worse than anybody else. Maybe other people acted in the world much worse than us. But that which could be tolerated in other states could not be excused in that of Israel. The double standard that we moan about and complain about and talk about when we look at the news, this could have been written this week. It's built in, says Rav Hirsch. That's how it's meant to be. There's meant to be a double standard. That which people can tolerate in Syria, in Iraq, in the Far East, in Africa, no one can tolerate when it comes to us. That's built into the system. For Israel's special office was to keep itself pure from all sin and perversity, since Hashem was its God. Destruction and misfortune are therefore no less instructive for Israel than prosperity. In other words, don't think of Galut as an unmitigated disaster which we just need to get out of. So that's a missed opportunity itself. Dispersion opened up a new great and widespread field for the fulfillment of its mission. But before the great wanderings of the Jews through the ages and among the nations truly began, God first gathered them once more upon their home soil. Rav Hirsch takes the view of the Ramban, which is picked up also by the Emes Liakov, Rav Yav Kamenetsky, that the second Beis HaMikdash was also a period of Galut. It was just a lesser form of Galut to prepare us for the real Galut. Meaning, the first Beit HaMikdash was Geula. Then we went into exile with Sancheret to Bavel. And it was abundantly clear after 70 years that we couldn't cope with exile. We would literally fall apart. So God brought us back to Eretz Israel for a brief 300-400 year respite where there was a galut which was not so bad as a galut. We lived in our own land. We didn't have independence. We were controlled by the Greeks, by the Romans, etc., by the Persians originally. It was a kind of galut within Eretz Israel itself. That was just a preparation, says Rav Hirsch, for the real deal. There in their national home they bound even closer to themselves the Torah, which was henceforth to be the sole bond to hold them together. And if you think about it, Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Torah that we have today that binds us together in the Galut, was created to a large degree in the second Beit HaMikdash. That's when this whole Galut infrastructure was put together. On the very eve of the exile, one branch left the parent tree. What's he talking about? This branch had to alienate itself to a certain degree from the latter in order to bring to the world, which had sunk to the depths of polytheism, violence, immorality, and inhumanity, the tidings, good news in Greek means gospel, of the existence of the All-One, of the brotherhood of man, of his superiority to the beast, and to teach the nations to cast off the bondage of worship, of wealth, and lust. So what's he talking about? Christianity. He's saying Christianity is also part of the process of our Galut, which was broken off just before we went into our Galut, to help us, on a certain Gadol level, to bring to the world the message that we needed to bring to the world. Now the nation was scattered to the four corners of the earth, among all the nations and unto the regions of the world, in order that in dispersion it might fulfill its mission back to the wilderness, said the prophet. I'm not going to read all the lines from Yeshaya. So the first thing Rav Hirsch says is, Galut is not just a punishment, it's an opportunity. It's an opportunity for us to rid ourselves of the money focus, of the property focus, of the possession, materialism focus, which is what drove us to destruction in the first place. Because in Galut we don't have any material means. And therefore, hopefully we can get that out of our system. Did we get it out of our system? That's a good question. Okay? That's maybe one of the reasons that we say at the beginning, I said at the beginning, any generation which has not yet seen the rebuilding is guilty of the same misdeeds as the early one. And indeed, says Rav Hirsch over the page, Israel accomplished its task better in exile than in the full possession of its prosperity. The main purpose of Galutz was to make Israel a better nation. With its own eyes, Israel beheld the destruction of the power and splendor which had dazzled it and which had begun to worship as its gods. Could it then ever again adore wealth, power, grandeur as the gods of life? Now you have to understand, Rav Hirsch is writing this at a time when the Jews are once again just beginning to come back to the middle classes, to the professional classes, to regain something of that status in society and wealth that from the exile until the late 18th century the Jews had been denied. The Jews had been denied access to wealth until the late 17th, early 1800s. Now Rav Hirsch is writing to a generation which is once again building grand palatial homes in Germany and in England. Think of the Rothschilds, etc., etc., all around Europe. And he's trying to tell them, think about what the Galut was for and whether we can bring it with us back into our lesser Galut. Could it then ever again adore wealth, power, grandeur as the gods of life? Devoid of the power, splendor, bereft of the brilliant show of human grandeur, Israel was upheld by its faithfulness towards the All One. The spirit and the maintenance of the only treasure which he could rescue, the Torah, kept it alive amidst suffering and agony and enabled it to endure all the blows dealt to it by savage fanaticism unleashed. Other states elsewhere in all the glory of human power and arrogance disappeared from the face of the earth. And this of course is well known. This is the irony, which of course we don't see as an irony of history, that all the states that had the material power, all the cultures and empires that had that status, they all fell away, because that status is not, as we saw ourselves, a guarantee of future. While Israel, though devoid of might and splendor, lived on because of its loyalty to God and his Torah. Could Israel then refuse to acknowledge the All One and his God and to accept the Torah as its sole mission on earth? And therefore, the Jewish history in this sense is an ongoing inspiration for us. The Galut, in a certain way, is a way to keep us focused on this mission that we have to try and bring something to the world which it lacks. And in truth, it proved that this training had not been in vain. 1,000 times, delusion armed with violence has opened to Israel a path to the fullness of earthly happiness. If only it would with a single word declare its rejection of God and disregard of the Torah. So many times we were forced with options, convert or die. But every time Israel would scornfully cast aside this tempting key to an easy life, preferring rather to bow its neck to the executioner's blow. It even sacrificed its own scanty measure of happiness, the most precious treasures of life on earth, wife, children, parents, brothers, sisters, life, property, and all the joys of earthly existence. It is written with Israel's heart blood upon all the pages of history that there is one but one God, and there are higher and better things for mankind than wealth and pleasure. From time to time we think that we really did it. From time to time we feel that we've really brought that message to the world. It's often shocking to us when the world reveals to us that it has not yet received that message. The message of the French Revolution in many ways was a very Jewish message. Egalite, fraternity, paternity, and the idea of not discriminating against people, of not having an oppressive church. The Jewish people felt very much in the 18th century that this message was spreading. That Napoleon, a lot of the Jews felt that Napoleon was really a very Jewish idea, and Napoleon himself felt that he had almost a Jewish messianic purpose. When he wanted to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, he sent a letter to the Jews of Israel. If you allow me, if you fight for me, I will help you build the Beit HaMikdash. The French Revolution was an enormous moment of inspiration for the Jewish people. Which is why in 1894, just 100 years later, when the Dreyfus Affair hit the Jewish people so hard, the shock was so strong, they said, how can this be? How can this be that a world that we thought we'd brought to a sense of understanding of the need to speak rather than kill, how can it be that it just turned back on us in this vicious anti-Semitic backlash that we were sure had been removed from the scene, especially in Europe, which was the civilized nations of the world? That was 100 years after the French Revolution. And 100 years after Dreyfus, the same thing is happening again. The same thing when we feel, how could it be that this Saturday, this Shabbat, there's a million-man march planned for central London in support of Hamas? A million people they're trying to bring to march through London, carrying slogans anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian, which means pro-Hamas, pro-Intifada, etc. And we look, we think, like, it's a Dreyfus moment almost. I'm not one of these people that says, oh, it's 1933 all over again. I don't think that's true. But I think it's a Dreyfus moment, a moment where we think, how could this happen all over again? And the truth is, that's part of the process of Galut that's written in, that we have to be working on this, even though it's turning back in our faces all the time. Says Rav Hirsch on a note of optimism at the very end, if, however, in the midst of a world which worships wealth and lust, Israel were to live the tranquil life of righteousness and love, if while everywhere else the generations of man are rapidly sinking into the depths of sensuality and immorality, and he was writing this in 1836, what he would have thought if he was walking around in 2014 is an interesting question. If in the world in which he lived, which he said was in the depths of sensuality and immorality, Israel's sons and daughters should bloom forth in the splendor of youth, purity and innocence, ah, he says, what a powerful instrument for the good could Israel be. If, though everywhere else avarice, lust and greed should become motives for human action, every Jew would be a mutely eloquent example and teacher of universal righteousness and universal love. If thus the dispersed of Israel were to show themselves everywhere on earth as the glorious priests of God and pure humanity, if only we were or would become that which we should be, if only our lives were a perfect reflection of our Torah, of our law, what a mighty force we would constitute for steering mankind to the final goal of all human education. This would affect mankind more quietly, but more forcefully and profoundly than our tragic record of suffering, powerfully though this latter proclaims the intervention of providence in human affairs. When such an ideal and such a mission awaits us, can we still, dear Benjamin, deplore our fate? Benjamin is the fictitious character to which he's writing these letters. Meaning Rav Hirsch is saying, now that we're living in the Galut, which is opening up the possibility of the Jews taking a more proactive role in society and not being shoved into ghettos and persecuted, how much more can we use that Galut as an opportunity? But if only we do what we're meant to do, which brings the two themes of Galut completely together. Like we said at the beginning, Chazal said, why are we in Galut? Mipnei chataeinu. Why are we in Galut? To spread a light to the non-Jewish world. Says Rav Hirsch, if we don't give in to the chataeinu, which he described very clearly were materialism, if we don't give in to that, then we can spread that mission to the non-Jewish world. But if we do, then we will be falling back into the same trap, the same cycle of chet that we were in before, which will not allow us to perform our mission properly. And therefore, I think that Rav Hirsch has set out a very interesting picture of exile, where the Jewish people are sown. Look at what he says in number 14. Hazoirim bedima berina yiktsoiru. Hashem hafach es Yisrael le Yisrael. This metamorphosis of Yisrael when we were in Geula to Yisrael when we're in Galut, et hasar im hakel, from the one who fights and battles with God, le zorea elokut, to one who sows godliness, in other words, Rav Hirsch picks up on this idea, Hazoirim Bedima, this sowing is the sowing of Yisrael within Galut, to spread, if we only know our own mission, to the non-Jewish world. Ad kan Rav Hirsch. In the remaining 15 minutes, I'd like to turn to Rav Kook.
Rav Kook has a slightly different perspective, as you'd expect Rav Kook to have. And he talks about things that are happening within Galut, which are beyond our understanding, but which are sowing the seeds for Geula in ways that become evident only later on. Have a look in number 15 and 16. I want to learn these two pieces with you in the next few remaining minutes. Look in number 15. Mitoch hamatzor shel Galut. From, do you want a sheet? From the sense of stop, the termination that comes with Galut. The first of the kinot this morning starts with the word Shabbat. It all came to an end. Okay? She'ein ruach Yisrael mitpashet bo lif'ol pulatav b'harchava, where we are no longer able to be active, proactive, and involve ourselves in the world. So what do we do in this period? Harehu mitamek yoter v'yoter. Instead of looking out during that galut, we can look in, looking more deeply and more deeply and even more deeply. We can prepare within ourselves a koach, the omets and the strength, gadol, which is so great, liyamei ha-geula, which is the only way we'll be able to deal with geula, b'rabim, which will then be public, ulupo'olateihem ha-klalim ha-gedolot ha-muzomanim lefanav. There are great times prepared for us, but unless we use galut and deepen our understandings of ourselves and the world around us, we won't be prepared for geula. Leman yeh ke'ilan, like a tree, he says, sheshroshav merubim, that its roots become very deep. Shebechol asher yidrabu sif otav, then with deep roots, if it wishes to grow wide branches, lo yanus lecho, then they won't be short of sustenance and moisture. V'hakol yitgaber v'yitaleh v'yaleh mileshed mayano hanoveya b'rav oz. And then the tree will be able to have something to draw from, the leshed, from the sustenance. Leshed is a word used for the man. Says Rav Kook, if we think that galut is just something to run away from, then we're missing the whole point. The galut is the place that we have to prepare what's needed for the geula. And if you think about it again, think about Torah Shabbat Alpeh. Think of the development of the whole halachic system, which would never have happened in the same way if not for the galut. Think of what we've been able to achieve, says Rav Kook, which only when we get to the geula will we realize the seeds of the galut. The seeds of the geula were sown in the galut. And in number 16, he brings an even more beautiful mashal. Where are the roots of galut? Where is the first time we see galut in the Tanakh? So you'll say, okay, so the primary galut, the original galut, is galut Mitzrayim. Okay.
Adam.
Oh, so he goes even further back. He says, Adam, Migan Eden. But he goes even further back than that. Even further back than the Gerush Migan Eden. He says the original galut was when Adam was put to sleep after his creation because he was alone and distressed. And if you think about it, I'd never thought about this until my son Asher pointed out this Rav Kook to me. I never thought about this in this way, that Adam HaRishon was created in a beautiful world, a world in which he felt alone, a world in which he felt lost, without a partner, without a function, without a purpose. So what does God do? He puts him to sleep. What a sad ending for a very hopeful story of the creation of mankind. And as far as Adam's concerned, that's it. He's fading away, slipping into a coma. Have a look in number 16. Ketchilat ha-yitzira bebinyan olam adei ad. Just like in the original creation of this binyan adei ad, which of course the binyan adei ad, we're talking about Adam and Chava. Holechet hi ha-hofa'a betoldot bnei Adam. There we see appearing, there in the original sleep of Adam, the pattern for future mankind. Shetamtzita mukar betoldot Yisrael, which we see also in essence within the Jewish people. Tardema nofelet, a great deep sleep falls. Ve'ein hanosim v'hanif'alim, and those
and now the steep he's going to compare to the galut. Those who are thrown around and moved around by the steep, they don't know enum yodim et ha'asuimam. They don't know what's happening to them. We seem to be thrown into a disaster. Tzla'ot nilkachim. Whole ribs are taken from us. Whole parts of us are excised from within us. The nechtachim are cut out from us. Whole sections of our people are just destroyed and removed from Am Yisrael. But mehem na'asim binyanim chutzavim. But from them are being created something that we never at the time realized was being created. Sheba achakach hoda. That afterwards we can turn around and say, Zot apam etzem ma'atzamai basam yisai. That Adam, when he sees afterwards that what came out of this galut that he thought was the end, was actually Chava, which is a very interesting idea. Rav Kook is painting Chava, the creation of Chava, as the Geula. What he discovered came out of this was something beyond any expectations. Nasot tnuot, we are thrown around in different movements, nitiot, in different directions, hofaot, haskalot, meridot, there are rebellions, tagarot, and quarrels, v'koach hatov v'hakodesh, nechlash, and we feel that the power of Kedusha has weakened. Umimkor elyon, but at the same time, from a higher source, shofot pulot. There are cogs whirring. There are things happening. She'ein shum dea mukra begvulea masiga et tivam. And we have no clue how they're really working. As far as we're concerned, we're having our kishkas taken out. But that's not what's really going on. What's really going on is the building of Chava, of something phenomenal, and to build the whole world. Ukavur moed hatardema, and during the actual period of the sleep itself, the high kitsa magat, the setting, like the concrete, the setting of the system, ro'im, then we begin to see sha'asui binyan adiyat, what actually happened, what was built. B'chlalut, and now he brings the nimshal, ha'galut ha'ihu ha'tardema, ha'yotel gudola va'aruka. Galut is the greatest of the deep sleeps. Ha'yinu k'cholmim. What we say in Shir HaMaalot, we look back at galut, and we say, we were in a bad dream. This was all, it all felt like we were sleeping. But all of the different the aspects of being created in the sleep, and what's really happening is all these things at the beginning that are confusing, and they make us almost feel sick. And he compares it almost to an operation. You have an operation and you come round and you feel worse before you feel better. You feel ill, you feel sick, etc. Umachovim, and the pain, ruchaniim v'gashmiim, which is both spiritual and physical, pirudim v'tagarot, and the splits and the arguments and the quarrels, v'achrekein, and afterwards nitamtza hamida, when things come into focus, nimtza ruchush chaim chadash. We find that that's actually built into a whole new world. Osa peirot, it makes new fruit. Upeirei peirot, nechmadim. Beautiful fruit that's never imagined. Mizot hachativa ba'atma, that actually comes from the incision itself, the cut itself, like the operation, where if you peep through the keyhole and you don't know the context, and you just see someone laying on a table and another person sticking a knife in them, you scream, murder, someone's killing someone, call the police. But actually when you look through the window, you realize, oh, actually this is an operation, this person's life is being saved, and they're being helped. Shalom Kul B'Shatah was not visible at the time, actually Yukul Mif'alot Tamim Deim, known to the in the wonders of the Hashem, who is the knower of all things, Umorer Yishenim, and the one who wakes the sleepers. This, of course, is very poetic, the Darko Hakodesh in Rav Kook, but he's saying some very important things, which is the Galut is very complex and is building the gula. And that's why the title that I was given for the shir of building the gula through the galut is very much what Rav Kook says is going on. Let me give you an example. And there are many examples. I mean, Rav Kook talks about many of them himself. He talks about the idea of the Haskalah, which hit the Jewish people in the 19th century as a disaster, was actually the movement that brought together the Hasidim and the Mitnagdim in a way which they could never have appreciated at the time, which built the 20th century of the Jewish people. He talks about the Kfirah, the heresies of the late 19th century, early 20th century, which actually, says Rav Kook, sharpened our understanding of Emunah and woke us up from the Emunah Pshuta, he said, which we'd relied on for so long, which was no longer good enough for the period of Gula. But I'd like to bring you another example, which Rav Kook also talks about. This today, and this whole week, is a very important anniversary, which if anyone has been watching any news beyond that which has been happening in the world, in Israel, the world still goes on beyond us. This, of course, has been the anniversary, the 100th anniversary of the outbreak of the First World War, which, from a Jewish perspective, is extremely important. Today, Tisha B'Av, 100 years ago in the year 5674, today is the morning that Germany declared war on Russia, which was the beginning of the First World War. And from the Jewish perspective at the time, it was nothing but an unmitigated disaster. 4 million Jews were caught in the middle of Central Europe, of Eastern Europe, when Russia then invaded Germany as part of the First World War. Germany recruited 100,000 Jews into the German army. Russia recruited 500,000 Jews into the Russian army. And when it invaded Eastern Europe, it displaced and expelled 600,000 more Jews that lived in Central and Eastern Europe. Think about this just for a second, from an internal Jewish perspective. 5 million boys have been called up in Russia into a vicious anti-Semitic Russian army. 600,000 Jews have been displaced from Central Europe in a financial and total disaster. We're so used to thinking of the Second World War and the Shoah, when people were killed, we forget that the First World War was the greatest disaster to hit the Jewish people since Churban Bayis Sheni until the Second World War. The Jews didn't know which way to turn. Who should they even support in this war? And of course, whoever they supported, they were accused by that side of being on the side of the other people. The Russians accused the Jews in their own army of fighting for the Germans, and the Germans accused the Jews in the German army of really fighting for the Russians. That's the nature of the way it goes. Many of the Jews actually decided at the time that the most favorable likely outcome of the war for the Jews of Europe would be that if Germany should win the war. Because Russia, at the end of the day, was a vicious, czarist, anti-Semitic, repressive regime in a way that Germany was not. And therefore the Jews even sent Hermann Cohen, one of the most famous Jewish philosophical figures of the early 20th century, the Jews sent Hermann Cohen to America to try and persuade the American government to join the war on the side of the Germans. Because that was the way that they felt that the war had to go when they were in the middle of the war. Now, what happened in the end? Things that nobody was even aware of at the time. There was a fellow, a chemist, living in England, a refugee, unknown, fellow called Chaim Weizmann. And he happened to have a formula to make explosives. And he happened to become known to Winston Churchill, who was the first Lord of the Admiralty, who said to him, "Look, you have explosives, or you can make them, and we need them, we need to win the war. Can you make us explosives?" And Chaim Weizmann went on a national campaign to try and make as much of this explosives as he could. In fact, they got the kids to gather together. I don't know what you even call them in America. In England, we call them conkers, horse chestnuts, things that grow on the trees and in autumn, because they were the source of this explosive chemical. As a result of the relationship between Churchill and Weizmann, because Weizmann came up with the goods, and the Germans were defeated. The German Navy was defeated by the British. So as a result of that, the Balfour Declaration, which by the way was opposed by most of the Jews of Britain at the time as being a disaster for the Jewish people, that there should be a Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration, despite Jewish opposition, was passed by the British government. The British in the end won the war. Beyond all expectations, the Ottoman Empire was destroyed. And by 1919, we ended up with a British mandate in Palestine, a British mandate and promise to build a homeland for the Jews, and none of that was in any sense remotely conceivable when the war broke out 100 years ago today in 1940. Now, the Jews who lived at the time must have surely felt that the wheels of Galut turn in directions which are unfathomable and unbelievable. And Rav Kook himself, after the war, felt that this was surely part of the Yad Hashem in directing the world in a certain way. And this is exactly what he's talking about, although he wrote this piece that I read for you at the beginning of the Second World War, before any of this was even apparent. He wrote it in Switzerland in 1914-15. Okay, so I just brought that in as an example of how what's going on with Rav Kook is really a microcosm of what we're experiencing. Nobody understands the way the Galut works. People who say they do are just talking slogans. People who are saying, "Oh, Mashiach is certainly round the corner." Halavai, Bezrat Hashem. But people who say this surely don't know this, because there is a complexity to the process of Galut which builds within it a process of Gula which will surprise us in ways that we have no idea at this stage that are going to happen. Let me finish with one line. The pasuk that we saw before has of Zriya, of Yisrael becoming Yisrael, is brought out in the in the Shir HaMa'alot that I want to finish with. I'm not going to cover all of the other sources. I'll just mention one of the other sources asked a beautiful question from Seder night. Why do we eat the Maror? Why did the Jewish people eat Maror in Mitzrayim? Think about it. In their festival of Gula, in their ceremony of Gula, of redemption, they had to eat Matzah. I understand Matzah. Matzah is all about freedom. It's all about redemption. Why did God tell the Jewish people to eat Maror? They didn't need to be reminded of the Maror. They'd lived through the Maror. They'd lived through the oppression of the Egyptians. Why are they eating Maror? And various sources I've brought you at the bottom, you'll see, if you look at them in your own time, are saying that the Jewish people also had to be taught there and then that the Maror that they went through was also part of the process of Geula. Only when they realize that the Maror was part of the process of Geula can they really appreciate the Geula. In fact, the Tzlach even calls the Maror the Geula Ha'amitit, which is an interesting point which you can get to when you look at them on your own. But let me just finish with one word. This idea of Hazoirim Bedi, Barina Yiktsoiru. This idea again of the Galut, Hainu Kucholmim, being a process of Zriya. We are being sown, we're sowing these seeds. We don't know what we're going to reap. And the seed, which all you see from the seed is it disintegrates, it breaks down, it decomposes. All you see of the seed inside the ground is a process of atrophy. You don't see any growth. Nevertheless, from that seed grows the tzemach. That's why Mashiach, who Chazal say midrashically, is born from Tisha B'Av, meaning, I think, not just born on Tisha B'Av, but born out of our understanding of Galut. If we get a deeper understanding of Galut, that brings us to an understanding of what is Mashiach. That's why Mashiach is born on Tisha B'Av. That process of Zriya is what in the end leads to Mashiach. I once heard a beautiful shir, I'll finish with this idea, from Rabbi Chaim Brovender. Rabbi Brovender was giving a shir on how the songs of Rav Shlomo Kalbach were not Stam songs. They were Perushim al Tanakh and Perushim al Chazal. the way he sang them and the way he phrased them was not just the way it felt like when he stood up on the stage, but it was from a deep understanding of the sources. He could, after all, have been a Rosh Hashiva had he not become Rav Shlomo Kalbach that he became. And therefore, Hazoirim Bedima Barina Yitzoiru. So one of the Rishonim, I think it's the Ritva, but I couldn't check exactly which one, says the Pshat is like this: Hazoirim Bedima Bedima Barina. If the people are able to sow Bedima in tears, but Bedima Barina, Hazoirim Bedima Barina Yitzoiru, meaning the Dima itself has to be Barina on a certain level. And if you listen, I don't suggest you do it today, maybe on another day we could have all started singing afterwards, but if you listen to when Rav Kalbach sings the song, he sings Hazoirim Bedima Bedima Barina, Hazoirim Bedima Barina Yitzoiru. That's how he sings the song, because that's the pshat and the rishonim that he's giving, which is that the Dima itself has to, on a certain level, even though it doesn't emotionally feel like it at the time, has to also be Barina, because of the understanding of what Rav Kook said, that the Dima itself and the Galut itself is the seeds for the Geula. If only we appreciate, like Rav Hirsch says, our mission in the Galut, what we're meant to do in the Galut, then we will Be'ezrat Hashem sow the seeds for a Geula Shlema, which will come partly through our own Tshuva, Hashiveinu Hashem v'nashuva alecha, and partly through our understanding that we gain on this day, which is the day for thinking about Galut Begadol and what it means for us for the future.